everybody to iloverealestate.tv. Great to have you guys all on board. Now, today what we're going to be covering is a couple of topics. First of all, we're going to explain the NRAS process and what that actually means for investors and from the developer's side as well. And we're also going to be talking about funding and settlements on properties and how long things take to get things done and what you should be doing, particularly from a build perspective, and what's the difference between building a house versus and getting the funding for it versus building a duplex or a triplex or even building 16 units. Now, the reason I say 16 units is because I actually have one of my students here, and she's well experienced in this because she's actually just completed a project of 16 units, which was rather challenging, let's say. So without further ado, let me introduce one of my students. Her name is Tamara. Hello, Tamara. How are you?
Hello, Dinta. Very good. Thank you.
Very good. Now, Tamara, as I said, you've just finished a block of 16 units. How would you describe the process?
The process is not for the faint-hearted, basically. Yes, I think you've really got to be persistent and be prepared to follow everything through to the nth degree. So nothing can really be left, whilst you may assume that you're paying your solicitor and you're paying, you know, your town planners and you're paying your surveyors and so forth. You really need to be the one that drives the whole process. So, you need to be prepared to be on the phone chasing every piece of paper, because just even to get, say, final titles at the end, which should be a week in titles, can blow out to 3 weeks just because this one piece of paper, isn't
gets
presented.
Lost on somebody's desk.
That's right. And that person, if you don't chase it up, is probably on holidays and nobody knew it was on their desk. So it is very much a, if you want to do it in a timely fashion, if you had, if you're prepared to do a project over, 2 or 3 years, then you could probably take a much more hands-off process. But yeah, if you've got things already sold and you've got to meet settlements, then yes, you've got to be prepared to
much, much bigger. Not where I prefer people to start, I can tell you.
That's right. I do believe you said probably shouldn't go ahead with it.
Well, I mean, hey, nobody can say you haven't been diligent in the process and certainly determined.
Well, I was already started. Starting something, then I finish it.
So, that's right.
Yes.
Okay, let's go back a little bit first of all, Tamara. Now, I want to explain NRAS to people because it's something that I get asked about all the time. I travel around Australia and things like that, and people come up to me and say, oh, what about NRAS? Do you think I should buy NRAS? Let's just explain what it is first of all and how it came to be. It's the National Rental Affordability Scheme, and it was an incentive basically from the current government to get essential services in areas that they determined were areas of need, yeah? And, that meant that people could, who qualified under the essential services, and we're talking firemen and police officers and nurses and teachers and people like that, and they had certain salary brackets that they had to fit into as well. And the low end was $40,000 for a single, wasn't it?
Yes.
So it's not really low. So $40,000 was the minimum for a single, and I think it went up to what, $120,000 or something for a couple?
Couples are about $76,000, but then once you throw in a child, then you're starting to really get up there. Yep.
Okay. So if they qualified from a salary perspective and a essential services perspective, they were then able to rent these houses, which all had to be new, and we'll get it around one of the little bitsy pieces in there, because you did a funny one there in the middle. With the new property, they were able to rent it at 80% of current market value. Now, you may think, well, that sounds great for the person renting, but why on earth would an investor want to invest in one of these things? And the flip side of that is that they got a tax-free cash back, not just rebate, but cash back, for 10 years, and it increased every year for 10 years. Is that right?
Yes, yep, that's it. So it, at the moment or this year, as of May, it is $9,981, and it increases based on a CPI adjustment of the rental rate. So it increased about $400 from the previous year, so that will continue to increase
Yeah. And the person gets that when they lodge their tax return, yeah?
Yes. Although you can actually do, I can't remember what form we're up to now, form 27D or something like that, which you could do with a normal rental property where you actually get the...
the benefit of the tax deduction paid back to you every week. So
yes.
Your
yep.
employer takes out less tax because you're covered under this
yes.
scheme, if
and
you like.
And you can do that
yep.
exactly the same.
Okay, so you get this tax-free money back. Now, you know, you think, okay, well, why would I want to do that? Obviously, if you're buying a property in an area that has good growth, which is the objective, buy a property in an area that's got good growth, you get this tax-free money back every year. Yes, you've got to rent it at 80% of current market value, but that's assessed every year. There's a rent-to-market review every 3 years?
No, every 12 months.
It's every 12 months?
Built into your lease that it will increase annually, and it's actually based on the rental increase in the closest capital city. So mm-hmm. Depending on your location, that's a benefit there.
Okay. So you get that money back. So by the time you add your cash, your tax-free money and the rent that you're actually getting, quite often after tax, you end up with more than you would have had you just rented it normally in the normal market.
Absolutely. So for a lot of properties, they would be negative geared
yep.
previously, but with NRAS, they're, depending on your income level, they're well positive.
And the higher income, obviously, the more they're suited to that person.
Yes, yeah. And NRAS works because the government incentive, the $9,981 a year, is exactly the same dollar amount regardless of whether you're purchasing a four-bedroom house and land package that might be $400,000 purchase price, as opposed to buying a one-bedroom apartment for $250,000. You still get that 9,000.
Same amount.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when you do a quick calculation on the yield, when you're discounting the rent by 20%, on the smaller properties, the NRAS incentive is actually doubling the rent, essentially.
Yeah.
So the yield is significantly
So if you're
better.
After cash flow, you're better off to go for a lower priced, smaller one better, as opposed to a larger house.
Yes.
And you try and buy these properties in areas that are that will have good growth over the 10 years.
Yes.
Now, the scheme lasts for 10 years, but you don't actually have to leave your property in the scheme. I mean, you can pull out at any time.
Yep, absolutely. So you could be, you could have it in, if you were, looking to retire in 5 years' time, you could leave it in the scheme for the first 5 years and be a property that then you moved into if you wanted to be owner-occupied. So yes, there's definitely that flexibility.
And historically, when properties have sold, because we've only really had it around for the last few years, they can command a slightly higher price tag if they've got NRAS attached to them than otherwise.
Yes, yeah. There's the other benefits really with the NRAS is from a rental perspective, you're getting quality tenants that are located close to their place of employment. So it might be, a nurse near yeah. the hospital. And because they're getting a 20% reduction on their rent, then all of the tenants are going to generally look after the property much better because as soon as they, it's just like a normal rental. If they did anything that jeopardised, their normal lease agreement, then they would be removed from the property. But then that removes them from the ability to enter into another NRAS property. So they, you've got good tenants. Everybody, lives well together. Mm. You don't get, if you've got a unit sort of project with multiple tenancies, everybody tends to live much better together.
More amicably.
Yes.
Okay. So you've actually been on the other side because you've been producing NRAS properties to the market and selling to investors and keeping some yourself. Now, let's backtrack a little bit. One of the early NRAS properties that you did was a little bit different because we say that the property has to be a new property, which, if you read all of the guff, that's what you'd read and that's what you'd expect. But you actually created a new property by moving an old property onto a newly subdivided block, and you actually got the approval for NRES on that property.
Yes, that's right. So what you need to be able to demonstrate is that you're creating additional accommodation that wasn't previously there. So in a normal situation, that's building something. For us, we purchased an existing house on a larger block of land. We were able to subdivide that and move another house on there. Whilst the physical house wasn't new, we were spending enough money on the relocation and the renovation that it was essentially new at the end. But it critically created an additional dwelling that wasn't previously in the rental market, and so that's
that qualified.
Yes,
and you got the NRAS classification on that, and you were able actually to sell that property with NRAS attached to it.
Yes,
fabulous. Okay, now let's go through one of your more recent ones, and that is the block of 16 units that you've built. Now, a big project, obviously. If somebody's out there thinking, okay, well, I'm building a block of whatever at the moment, how do I get NRAS qualifications to it? It's actually a little bit difficult now from a developer's perspective because they're all used up, are they not?
That's right. So sort of what you used to be able to do, you know, 18 months ago, there was actually a market for applying directly with the government and being able to receive an allocation, or alternatively, developers that already had allocations, if they weren't able to use them, then there was a market to buy an existing allocation and just have it put on to
assigned to your property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it.
Yep.
So that was sort of 12, 18 months ago. What has changed in between is that the government released their last round of allocations, mm-hmm. and that was well oversubscribed. So there are a lot of projects that never got approval. And so then anybody that actually, or any developer or consortium that had allocations, they sort of almost became like gold. And so they are just being held, and developer will go ahead with them, whereas previously there was actually a market to sell them
and they could make.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
So the government may do another round. They certainly may do another round of NRAS, round five. It's just a wait and see. So until they announce it, then nobody really knows. And when they announce it, it may be sort of some talk may be that it will only be released to the existing consortiums and to existing developers that have now got a proven track record for delivering the end product. So it's a little bit of a sort of wait and see.
Wait and see, yeah. Okay, so that's out of the question now for developing side of things. As an investor, we've explained how it works, and it does have some advantages. I look at it as being one of those things, it's a passive investment. And for passive investors, I'm not opposed to NRAS at all. It turns something that would normally have been negative into something that is positive, and that's always a good thing by my books. But if it's not a really aggressive strategy to get out there, let's get some more of this and do that and whatever else. It doesn't rebound you into the next deal as quickly. But then that's not everybody's style of investing either. You've used it the other way because you've been using it to develop, which is, as we've said, pretty much off the table now. Let's now talk though about not so much NRAS, but the process of actually building something, because there's lots of styles of building, and the most basic one, I guess, is a house and land package. And with a house and land package, you've got to ask yourself one question. You've got to ask yourself, what am I paying stamp duty on? Because if you're paying stamp duty on the land, then you're actually the developer. Because even though it might be sold as a house and land package, you're buying land, paying stamp duty on the land, and then you're actually contracting a builder to build X house on the land. Now, if you're building that for investment purposes, you must take into account GST. And with selling that property, if you sell it any time within the 5 years rather than rent it for 5 years, then you're actually selling a new property for the first time, and GST has to be taken into account. You have to pay GST to the tax office. And the thing that most people kind of miss out on here is that the price of a house is the price of a house. If you say it's a $400,000 house, it's a $400,000 house. Mum and dad that are going to buy it to live in it don't want to pay $400,000 plus GST. it's a $400,000 house, which means then that you, if you're the developer, and a lot of people miss the fact that they're actually the developer, you have to take that $400,000, divide it by 11, and remit that amount of money, which comes in at about, I don't know, $37,000, $36,000 or something, to the tax office. Now, admittedly, yes, you get credits against that because you get the credit for the GST that's been paid as part of the building and possibly on the land, depending on whether it was sold to you with GST or not. But most people don't realise that that money, they have to be registered for GST and they actually have to do something with this property. Now, all of that is negated if they're building it as their own home. But as soon as it becomes an investment property, that's exactly how it works. And people really get tripped up on this. And I can tell you now, there is major money set aside for audits in this area. And they are cross, this is the tax office, and they're cross-checking with the titling office on creation of new titles and buildings and all this sort of thing. And there will be some major letters going out for audits in this area. And people don't realise, you know, it's one of the most under-recognised areas of GST is this creation of a new property. So watch that space on that one. And when you are the developer, effectively, what I'm, just to reinforce that, if you've paid stamp duty on the land, not on the house and land value, then you are actually the developer and you've contracted a builder to build the house. If you've paid stamp duty on the house and land value, which is obviously going to be more, then they've already sold it to you for the first time. So when you then on-sell it anytime in the future, there is no GST to take into account because residential property particularly is input taxed. So that's how that works.
And I think another thing that people miss on that GST calculation, if you're getting construction finance through a bank will actually work on the pre-GST figure. So they will only give you construction finance on the excluding GST, but when you pay the builder, you obviously he needs to get his including GST. So you actually have to have cash flows sitting to the side, because what the bank is assuming is that you're remitting your BAS monthly, yep, and that the ATO is giving you back the GST that you paid the builder. But time frame wise, you actually have to have that cash to cover the shortfall.
And that's a little bit of a problem too, because the tax office is renowned for being slow as wet weeks in giving you a refund, but they're as sharp as the sharpest sword you can possibly have when you've got to pay them. I remember once I lodged a BAS statement on one of the development sites that I had, and it meant that I was getting a refund, because it was through the construction process, of $160,000. Now, that's obviously a decent refund. But I purposely timed the settlement and everything else so that it settled on the 30th of September. So that was the end of a quarter, which meant on the 1st of October I lodged my BAS statement so I could get my $160,000 back, you know, big refund. Well, of course it got audited. Didn't get assessed for 3 weeks. Of course it got audited. I was so on the money with giving them every piece of paperwork I could possibly, you know, that they could possibly ask for. As soon as they asked for it, I'd have it there. And I formed a friendship with the auditor and spoke to them at least every week about the progress and what was happening, and everything she asked for, I gave it to her, and I knew everything about this woman. I knew when she was going on holidays and I knew her family and her kids' names and everything. So I'm as polite as I can possibly be to everybody, doing everything that they could possibly ask. And I can tell you now, the only reason I got a refund before Christmas was because I made friends with that auditor. Mm. She was going on holidays, wasn't coming back until February. Had it just taken the normal course, then I would not have got my refund until March the following year. So from the 1st of October into March is how long I would have had to wait. And that's a lot of money. You know, that 160 grand out of your cash flow when you expect, oh, well, I'll just lodge my BAS and then I'll get it back and this will happen. It's sort of like, no, don't rely on it. It's, as soon as you start to have refunds from the tax office, they can take an incredible amount of time.
Absolutely.
So just be aware of that one too. Okay, so that's a normal construction. The house and land, everyone talks about house and land packages, and I think the whole process of whether you should buy one or you shouldn't buy one is for another time. But when you start stepping up the construction process, and it's not just a house that you're building, but it's, let's say, a duplex. Duplex, from a funding perspective, is very similar to a house. And typically what they will do when you go through the funding process is they'll look at your plans and they'll get a quantity surveyor to actually evaluate what your property will be worth when it's finished. They'll look at that value and they'll look at the costs that you're, you know, that you've been quoted and what your building contract says and things like that. And they will typically lend you between 70 to 80% of cost, whatever that is, which means you've got to have the other money or have it built in with equity in other properties. So that's pretty straightforward. It's residential lending. It's very similar in the assessment process of you and your assets and your income and everything else as a purchase of a house completely finished. So there's not much difference there really. And even when you step up another step and you build a triplex, depending on who you take it to and which strategist you use and things like that, they can normally get that through on a residential loan. So again, it's not a big difference from building a single house. And the LVRs or the loan ratios are going to be very similar to that of building a normal one house. Four, you're starting to step up into some bigger stuff. With four, if you know the right people, you know, you talk to the right banks, they'll still give you residential lending on it, but they're really looking at, okay, what are you going to do with it at the end? They may be looking for pre-sales, even on four, where if the rent coming in from the properties isn't sufficient to cover all of the mortgage and put some money back in your pockets, and that obviously has to be backed up by rental statements by the real estate agents and things like that as to what they're likely to be, then they're going to want some of them sold. And they might, if you're building a block of four as an example, they might want half of them sold as an example, which means that then you've got to go through the whole process of advertising the property and getting pre-sales on the property. Get up further than that and you're definitely into commercial territory, aren't we, Tamara, with our 16?
We are.
And that's a whole nother ballgame. And obviously the more units you have, the more stringent the scrutiny, the more capacity you've got to have behind you, and the more difficult it is to actually get that kind of finance. Before we really look at your story there and, you know, the road that had to be taken to get there, let's step back a bit and talk about this pre-sale process, because it's something that is probably foreign to most people. But really, you should be starting, if you're planning on selling anything, you should be starting the marketing of it pretty much as soon as you turn ground, even before.
Well before, yes.
So let's talk about that. You are remarkable in what you've put together with your sales documentation. And it's a shame this podcast can't actually show people what you've done, but you really did a great sales presentation to real estate agents and to investors even before you got the funding to actually build them. Do you want to go through that process and what you did to produce that brochure?
Yes, yeah. So obviously if you're trying to sell something off the plan, which is what you're doing with your pre-sales, most people can't visualise something, particularly if they're at the other end of the country. And so we started off getting artist impressions done.
How did you do that?
We got prices locally with, you know, people in Australia for artist impressions, and was slightly horrified by the prices that we were getting back. And somebody suggested to me just to have a look at website, sort of freelancer.
Elance and freelancer, both two websites that you do this sort of thing with. Yeah,
that's right. So having never been on them before, but then, you know, spending a couple hours one evening. And I've since worked out that you can outsource everything. I did a very long, arduous PhD, and I reckon now I could have outsourced almost all of that.
Don't be telling everybody that.
No, if you haven't been on these websites to see what you can outsource, it's quite unbelievable. So I got in there, had a look at some examples of other ads that had been put on there. So basically you're creating an ad for work that you want done, and then you set your, you know, sort of what the end product is that you want. So I told them, you know, what format I wanted the images to be in, and, you know, how many images I wanted. And I then gave them a price range, and that was it. It didn't cost anything. I just put the ad on there. So then 24 hours later, was absolutely blown away by the fact that I had about 100 email responses from all over the world. It took me about 2 days just to go through them all. So these are all people that are then submitting their application, essentially, to do your work. So from that, we whittled it down to a fantastic designer in... Actually, he was based in London, so we actually got the artist impressions done by a company in London, and even the time frame worked perfectly because he was working during the day while and then at night while I'm sleeping I'd get up, and then so we had a 24-hour sort of cycle going on. So anyway, got fantastic artist impressions, which I'm quite happy to now put up against the actual project, and it is almost perfect. The colouring right down to the fencing, even the builder used the artist impressions to be able to see what the end product.
That's what I was going to say. You had a few talks with the builder, and you pulled out the artist's impressions and go, no, this is what I want. This is the colour, this is the way that has to look, etc. So even from a builder's perspective, he could really see what was in your mind about how it was going to look.
That's right. And so they were done 3D. So with all of this, the more time and effort you can put into the planning stage before you even start physically building anything. So the more detailed your specifications are, the more detailed your artist impressions are, then the better the end product's going to be.
Okay, so for $250, you got this beautiful brochure done. But you were very instrumental in that, because the artist impressions are one thing, but you really put in, you know, the whole story about where your property was and its location and the demographics and the tax benefit to the end user and, you know, what it meant to people and you really painted the picture of exactly what it was going to be like to own this property and how fabulous it was going to be for the person who was buying it.
That's right. I mean, you're essentially selling the sizzle, I suppose.
You are.
I mean, it's a piece of paper, really. And you've got to, you know, explain to them all the, you know, the benefits and why your property, you know, is advantageous over the next property. Mm-hmm. So you've really got to, you know, put yourself in the position of the investor and, you know, really articulate clearly and simply to them, you know, what this product is going to deliver to them. And so we did that in a sort of very succinct brochure type format. You know, we branded it, so we came up with a name for the project and a logo for the project, so that, you know, every meeting, every conversation we had from then on, that brochure was key. So every meeting with a bank, you know, anybody that we needed to talk to about the project, we had this brochure. So immediately they had a feel for what you were talking about, rather than just saying, oh, we're building 16 apartments. They could actually see and feel, even just from your logo, you know, what you were trying to create.
So everything was professional from the day you started.
Yes. And I think if you...
It should be too.
That's right, because as soon as there's a... It's very different investing and doing projects for yourself where you're holding it. As soon as you're relying on selling something, then, you know, the level of professionalism really absolutely has to be there. And then it takes it another step further if you're trying to sell off the plan, because you actually don't have the physical product. So across the board, talking to, you know, agents, valuers, there actually is not anything there at this point in time, and yet people, you know, have to be confident enough that they're prepared to A, sign a contract, go unconditional, give you 10% deposit that's sitting in a trust account before you've even started to do anything on site.
That's right. So it is a big ask, and I mean, you know, you really have to sell it to the agents, because they're the ones that are then dealing with the people at the other end. And just think about it from their perspective. You know, if they've got two projects on their table and one's a bit of an email listing the address of the property and other things, which is what most people do. That's the end of it. Versus you, that's come in with this, how many pages? What, 21 pages or something ridiculous? No, not ridiculous, beautiful. But it's, you know, a big chunky brochure and colour and logos and, you know, artist's impression and the whole thing. I mean, yours is an easy sell. And you had digital format, you had printed format, you had everything. So it was an easy sell to sell yours. So, of course, you know, yours got sold out in a very short space of time, didn't they?
That's right. And because you're disconnected from the actual end purchaser, you know, if I know my project intimately, yeah, but I can't expect the real estate agent to remember or, you know, even understand some, yeah, of the, you know, the ideas. So you really have to have it documented so they can just, they're really just the conduit, you know, yeah, they're just passing the information on and hopefully at the end, you know, they're negotiating the contract. When you're doing offer plan, it's, you're not usually negotiating on the price anyway. So there, you know, you really, the more you can provide them to make the process easier for them and for them to, you know, work with their client to get a sale over the line, then, yeah, the whole system sort of works.
Good. Fabulous. Okay, so how quickly did you sell those off?
The majority sold within the first sort of 6 to 8 weeks.
See, that's amazing for 16 units. To sell that many. I mean, I know you didn't sell them all because you're keeping a few, but, you know, just to be able to sell them off that quickly, because some developers wait 4, 5, 6, 8, 12 months to be able to sell off enough to get their financing.
And so that's right. When you go, you know, so when we went to the bank, we already had, of the 16, we had 10 pre-sales, and that's what the bank needed because they want to make sure they've got their debt covered. And, you know, if we weren't at that level, then they would say, come back once you've got pre-sales.
So. Yeah. So you've gone through and basically they're signing, 10% deposit's been deposited into a trust account. They're signing saying, yes, I'm going to buy it at a point in time in the future when they're finished, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you've got deadlines and you've got requirements to meet there because you have to have it delivered by certain time frames that you said you would have it delivered by. How did you go with that? What was the emotional roller coaster with that stuff?
So the main deadline for us was the actual NRAS. So when you receive an NRAS allocation and you've applied for it through the normal system, you actually had an end date that you were proposing that you would have the apartments ready for tenanting by, and the government absolutely was sticking to that. So our time frame was very much governed on that. If you didn't have NRAS and you were just developing a project and then selling off the plan, the solicitors will always write in a sunset clause, and you know, a sunset clause can often be a year or two. So when it's selling off the plan,
it has to be delivered by a certain date.
Yes, yeah, and that's usually a year or two beyond what you actually predict your finished build time to be anyway. So they're really making allowances for, you know, some sort of major delays. But what they don't want is if that sunset clause is too tight, then if you did have a delay, then that purchaser may actually be able to get out of the contract because you haven't met the timeframes. So for us, you know, we had a great builder and he delivered it ahead of the schedule that he had set. And so, yes, we were able to bring everything in on time.
Good. Okay, so just talk about the process that you went through to get the bank funding, because you knocked on a lot of doors.
Yes, I suppose with ours, we had some interesting characteristics, A being NRAS. So whilst NRAS is, you know, certainly becoming more and more known, you know, almost each month, for banks to actually finance an NRAS product, that certainly added a level of complexity to our project. We also, as Dipna had highlighted, you know, once you're doing 16, that's, you know, that limits the number of financiers that are prepared to do that type of project. And really, you know, there is still the aftermath of the GFC and a lot of the financiers and some of the smaller financiers that, you know, may have been more open to these types of deals, you know, have closed their books. So, yes, I did have several conversations with Dibner saying, okay, so...
what else can we do? Who else can I talk to?
That's right. And, you know, we were just very fortunate that the bank that we ended up going with, and it was one of the majors, that they had recently changed their policy and in terms of NRAS, and they had a new general manager, and he was very progressive, and so it was just good timing for us. But with that, we also did go through a commercial broker. So whilst that comes at a very hefty cost, they are basically able to equally present the project to their contacts and their their lenders that you may not have access to sort of through the normal channels.
Because you went down superannuation funds and private lending.
Oh, I'd forgotten all that.
Raised it as a bad memory, was it?
I'm sort of working on the whole process to be a little bit like childbirth, and that after sort of 12 months you forget that the labour is actually quite... Sorry to those people that haven't had a baby yet.
Just a bit too graphic. But you did. I mean, and, I take my hat off to you. It is about that determination and persistence and knocking on all those doors, because it was in the middle of GFC. And you were looking at joint ventures with superannuation funds and joint ventures with builders and private lenders and all of those sorts of things, which in any of that market, and I mean, maybe that's a talk for another time, but in any of that market, you've got to be prepared to knock on a lot of doors, knowing that you're going to get a lot of no's and go down a lot of dead ends that, are going to be yes, 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 and then a no at the end. Because that's just the nature of that market. But it is a way of getting a lot of those more difficult projects, and I wouldn't put yours into the, really difficult, but more difficult projects off the ground. So just be prepared to do that. It's not as all as, okay, I'll go to the bank, and then if they say no, you go, oh, well, that's all I can do. You really do have to knock on a lot of doors and be prepared to do so.
And I think also I was having a conversation with my 7-year-old.
Did they give you financial advice, did he?
No, but it was something about that you have to be uncomfortable. And I was just walking out the door. Pretty much every day I am uncomfortable at some level, more uncomfortable with, whatever I'm having to do. So, whether it's meeting another valuer and going, through another valuation process, you really do have to be prepared to just, have some level of confidence in the product that you're promoting, and that's where, again, having a good brochure and all of that backup information, then, you've got some sort of ammunition. But, yes, it is something that you just have to be prepared to go out there and back yourself and back the project. And if it's a no, then it's not personal. It's just that they're lending criteria.
It's a no at this point in time.
Yes.
Actually, you did spend a lot of time with valuers and going backwards and forwards and arguing your point, and because you were trailblazing to a lot of large degree, creating a product which there was no precedence for. There was nothing like it around within like 300Ks or something ridiculous, 200Ks. You did a lot of trailblazing, and that was a lot of education that you had to do to valuers in order to get your valuation where you needed them, to get the funding, to get the sales, to get the project off the ground.
And even beyond that, whilst you got the initial valuations over the line, then, of course, they're going to revalue it once it's closer to settlement. Mm. So when you've got everything pre-sold and you're finished construction and you think everybody is saying to you, you should be able to sit back and relax, your job has only just begun, because then the banks want to refinance everything. Mm. So you start the whole process again. And again, yes, you have to be... you have to be prepared to be the one to meet them on site. Never let a valuer on your site without you being
ever.
There.
And you guard who they talk to on site.
Absolutely. So, yes, it's where you really have to be committed to have that involvement. You know, you can't just sort of allow a valuer to come. And even if you've got, you know, the first half a dozen all gone through fine, you know, you just can't assume anything. So you really need to be prepared to present to the valuers. And again, the brochure comes back out and all the, you know, more recent information you've got.
And with that, I mean, we're now talking about you doing handover, because you've just handed over a good percentage of them already to the end owner, and their bank has sent out a valuer to go through. So this is the second lot of valuers that you're dealing with.
We're actually up to three for some of them.
So you're actually really making sure that the investor buying your end product is getting the best out of the process, because the best possible valuation, so that they can get their funding so they can buy your unit.
And so, exactly, and then you have to be prepared to actually work with their broker or their bank. So, you know, by the end I know every purchaser's broker, their solicitors, their bank, so their if they're going directly with a bank. So you actually have to, again, be prepared to intervene and work with their brokers, because it's very much a joint project at that point to, you know, to get this sale across the line for their clients. So, yeah.
The other thing that you've been particularly good with, because I've seen the emails because you copied me in, was all of the ongoing correspondence with each one of the purchasers between when they signed up to go, yes, I'll buy the property when it's finished, right through to completion, and after completion saying, congratulations, you know, great job, da-da-da-da-da. You've been in constant contact with them, with updates of photographs and where we're at and, you know, all that kind of stuff, which is amazing.
Yes, again, you know, these people are purchasing off the plan, and whilst a lot of projects they would buy off the plan and they never hear about it until, you know, a month before it's ready to settle, again, people have sort of put faith in you know, the project and have certainly put down their hard cash, their 10% deposit. And so from my perspective, also to maintain their level of confidence in the project by communicating, so I would send out a monthly update email to everybody, and that's, when I say everybody, that's down to solicitors, the property managers, you know, the banks. So my emails are going direct to the bank, so, you know, there was no separation between, you know, what I would tell them in private conversation and what I was actually telling everybody else. They were getting exactly the same information as everybody else. And so with those monthly emails, a lot of our purchasers also got the benefit of the building boost. So anything that was sort of going on with our project along the way, you know, I included in the update email, down to we're tenanting a lot of them prior to settlement. And so, you know, towards the end, we're talking about, you know, what we've done in terms of advertising for tenanting and, yeah, just basically keeping people up to speed with, you know, where they're, you know, where the project is at. And so, again, that gives them confidence. So if there was, you know, a slight delay or, you know, a hiccup along the way, then the fact that they feel like they're part of the process, and it's, you know, it's their project as much as it's mine, then...
So if somebody was marginal and perhaps want to pull out of the contract, they'll be less likely to pull out of yours because they've been emotionally and realistically involved in the project all the way through. It's kind of like they've had the experience along with you.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I mean, I'm you know, pleased to hear when, you know, many of them have said how fantastic it was that they were getting these updates and they really felt like they were part of the process, even though, you know, a lot of them are on the other side of the country.
Yeah.
So, and then I've, you know, got to meet quite a few of them, those that have chosen to come and have a look at it before settlement. And yeah, so it's nice that they're being part of the journey.
And you even sent out a little congratulations email, etc., when they've actually settled and it's all finalised. And I hear you had an interesting one last week.
Well, just today, it settled on Tuesday and I sent an email to say, you know, congratulations on the settlement and thank you for settling on time. And then I got an email come back to say, oh, has it settled? And, oh, well, got on to the bank then. And I sent an email back to say, I need to take a leaf out of your book, because he was very chilled about the whole process. And he said, oh, yeah. And then he sent an email back to say, oh, yeah, I did talk to the bank a couple of months ago, but, oh, well, they must have dealt with it. So he has, and he was one that we've tenanted, so a lot of them we've tenanted in advance. So as far as he's concerned, he's got a tenant before it's settled. It's settled without him knowing, and
done
he's
and
got
dusted.
Rent coming in, you know, as of the day it settles. So, yes.
I'd say to be a fairly small component of his overall portfolio.
Probably of his income level, I suggest. Yes.
Very good. Okay, so I guess my overall advice here is don't try and take on a larger project until you've cut your teeth on a few smaller ones, because you've had a background in providing similar size projects to the market and things like that before. So it's not exactly your first one. But if somebody is starting out, you know, try duplex first, maybe triplex, maybe a fourplex, but let's not go too much bigger than that if you've never done it before. I like duplexes, obviously, because you get the double income, and triplexes, and the more multiple income stream properties you've got, the better the yield's going to be, the better the overall investment's going to be. But don't go too big too soon. Please stick with a smaller one, a construction deal to start with. Maybe not a house, maybe a duplex. You know, that's not too much of a stretch at all. But just watch that GST issue and whether you have to pay GST or not. Because obviously your project, definitely GST on everything all the way through. But I know for smaller investors just starting out there, they really do get tripped up on this GST issue. And there is a lot of audit that will go back literally years and start penalising on GST if the right amount of GST hasn't been paid. And as soon as it's not your own home that you're building, as soon as it's an investment property of any description, if you've paid stamp duty on the land, you're the developer, you're the one who has to take account of the GST when you ultimately sell it. So, Tamara, having been somebody who's built quite a bit over the years, what would be your parting advice, we'll say, to somebody starting out thinking and about, you know, doing one for the first time?
I'm sort of attention to detail, so you need to take that into account. But I really think that people need to be across the board their whole project. So whilst you're employing an engineer and you're employing your town planner and you're employing your surveyor and everybody else, and they should be doing their own field, you really need to be across the board for the whole project, because the engineer will make a decision and draw something on the piece, you know, on the plan, but you will know because of your involvement that actually that's going to impact on the hydraulics engineer who's doing his own plans that are separate. And yes, the builder should pick up on this, but that can be quite a way through the process. So I really think, if anything, you need to be across the board for your whole project, and don't be reluctant to put red pen on any plans or on any document. You know, my solicitor, my accountant, everybody's prepared to see a lot of red pen just because you're paying these people good money. You know, they are human, they do make mistakes, and so you need to read everything and be confident that, you know, that you're on top of all of the detail, and to ask questions. So I spend my whole time asking questions. So if there's something that I'm not sure about, just ask a question. You know, I don't care whether it sounds a silly question or the answer is obvious. I think that that's the one thing that people don't do enough of, and that's to ask questions of all of their, you know, whether it's your engineers, your surveyors, because I want to be educating myself. I want to have the knowledge so that I can then use that in the next project. Rather than, yes, being, you know, in the dark with things.
Very good point. And, you know, it's something that, don't be afraid of construction. I think construction is a great strategy, but please keep it small. And it's when you have a smaller project and you make a mistake, it's only a small mistake. When you have a big project, you make a mistake, it's a big mistake and can be very, very costly. So let's learn on the smaller ones, get a few under your teeth before you start tackling anything too big. So guys, that's it for me this week. Thank you so much, Tamara, for coming on and sharing your stories with us. And I'll be back again to talk to everybody very, very soon. And don't forget to check out all of the past copies on www.iloverealestate.tv of all my other podcasts, because there's a huge amount of information there for you to jump on and listen to while you're jogging or walking or whatever. Anyway, bye for now, guys. We'll catch you next time.